Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This neuroscience hack called body doubling. You subconsciously mirror the behaviors that you're ambiently observing. It's why you yawn when someone else yawns. What would work look like if we flipped it to embed these practices?
Working from home seems great. You can do the washing when you want, exercise when you want, and put it all back on by visiting the fridge whenever you want.
Well, empathize with it.
What could possibly be the downside? Well, there can be disconnection from the company you work for and the company you keep.
Bumping into someone as you walked in or chatting to someone over a water cooler.
Leading to a rise in distraction and loneliness. Alethea Navarro is a serial entrepreneur trying to fix that.
Well, I remember talking to one of the founders of Uber when they were still called Uber Cab.
She is the founder of Flow, a platform for virtual co-working, which is trying to help people tap into deep work, the super productive mental state.
I mean, I think it's quite genius.
It's like if Peloton and the mindfulness app Calm had a baby, but for work.
Yes, you could exercise by yourself, but it is a lot easier, a lot more effective if you've paid something to do it. There's a really charismatic instructor turning what would otherwise be a very dull task into a produced event that is unique and full of content and personality. And you're surrounded by other people who are also showing up there to do the same thing.
It's not her first time as an entrepreneur either. Nearly 15 years ago, she accidentally stumbled upon and helped invent a product that is now the backbone of the influencer economy.
It was a complete accident.
Affiliate links. And it would never have happened had she not been rejected in a job interview by Google Maps.
So bad that at one stage I had to stop the interview to say, I actually am a smart person, I'm so sorry.
Aside from all that, we dig into what humans need to max their potential.
Success is just a choice.
What it's like partying with Snoop Dogg.
And we'd turn a derelict warehouse into a pop-up party with Snoop Dogg performing.
And why she always swears in job interviews.
I like to swear a little bit in an interview.
Tell us about Flow. Let's start with that. Let's start with what you're doing at the moment.
Basically, it's a virtual co-working platform that helps you achieve both focus and feel a little bit less isolated while you're working remotely.
Yes.
So it uses this, it leverages this neuroscience hack called body doubling, which is basically when you are doing something in the presence of someone else. It's why studying in a library was really effective, because you were surrounded by other people and you subconsciously mirror the behaviors that you're ambiently observing. It's why you yawn when someone else yawns. And so it turns out when you observe other people focused and working at their computer, virtually on your computer, it makes it easier for you to also then stay grounded, stay focused. The added benefit is that for a lot of people that post-pandemic are now working from home a lot of the time and can feel a little bit flat and a little bit isolated, this pseudo-community, this sense of the casual encounters that we used to experience when we went into an office, bumping into someone as you walked in or chatting to someone over a water cooler, we can also replicate that to a degree. And so you get not only more done, but you end up feeling great at the end of your workday. So that's what Flow offers.
And where does the name come from?
I mean, I think it's quite genius. It's a play on the concept of flow states, which is that state that you get into when you're really immersed and focused on a particular task. And so, I wanted to encapsulate that concept of flow states, but also the science of flow states and deep work, which is the book that really inspired a lot of what Flown does now, is all about the fact that when you do get these moments of working in this way, you feel amazing. So you achieve great heights. So Flown being the past tense of flying, it's the state that you will feel at the end of a session on Flown.
And what is deep work?
It's a concept that was coined by this professor at Georgetown University called Cal Newport. He wrote a book called Deep Work. And this book was just so inspiring because it turns out it wasn't just me that was experiencing these moments of flow state that made me super productive, creative, and joyful at the end of a flow state session. But this book, Deep Work, also demonstrated that the history of humans' greatest achievements come from building more deep work into the way that we work. So great philosophers, great scientists, authors, all great thinkers have embedded a deep work practice into their life, and that is the source of their most significant work. You still sometimes need time to do the shallow work, answering the emails and doing the admin, but if you want to really create significant value or learn new skills, you need to embed a deep work practice, which involves, chunks of time where you're working in a distraction-free environment, and you're also interweaving a whole set of other practices around. You're going for walks in nature. You're taking time to be playful. You're taking time to rest. You're being exposed to new people and ideas. And so there's this constellation of factors that when you weave them into your workday not only help you produce significant meaningful work that is impactful to the world and that you're proud of, but you feel really good as well. This has been knowledge for how great philosophers and thinkers have done their work for millennia, and yet the way that we were structuring the modern day office environment was almost the exact opposite of these ingredients. So that's what I wanted to do with Flown, and I ended up really focusing on and in fact all those ingredients to a degree you get on the platform, but at its heart we leverage this concept of body doubling because that achieves both the state of flow and focus, and also gives you that sense of human connectedness that is so important for us as humans, particularly in this increasingly atomized landscape that we're all in.
And was it the book that really sort of was the kind of ignition catalyst moment then for the startup?
There's never really, I mean, for me, the basically I had left my last company. I'd run it for 11 years and I had chosen to step down because I love being a founder, and after 11 years, I wanted to go back to early stage, or at least have a break.
Yeah.
And so I took, 2 years off. I didn't know it was going to be 2 years. I just took time and used that time to just see where, the strands of fate and happenstance would take me. And partly it was the book, partly I did a lot of nomading and just adventuring. And read lots of books, talked to lots of people. And there was this persistent theme, I guess, around these states that we can get into that can be so transformational. The book was part of it, but I also experienced it myself extensively. I spoke to a lot of people that were also really passionate about this. And so I started playing with the idea. So I started running these retreats, these deep work retreats. I was nomading in the middle of northern Spain, in Asturias, and then decided to rent a beautiful villa in the middle of a forest in Galicia. And while I'm traveling and living out of, Airbnbs and cabins with my little dog, I ended up, getting a designer on Upwork and creating signage and booklets and a website, and I invited, my extended network to come and do deep work for a few days at this retreat. And I basically turned this house into this idyllic retreat for coming away to work on something significant for a few days.
Yeah.
And so I did that then a few times, first in Galicia, and then I rented this amazing chateau in France for a couple of weeks. And then I also rented this like townhouse in Lisbon. And each time I did it, I was iterating and testing different ideas about what kind of rituals, like secular rituals, helped people both connect and achieve this focused creative state, and what were the other ingredients that worked. And so a lot of that experimentation became the kernels of what Flown began.
And what things did work in those environments then?
So intention setting was a really big one, and there's a lot of science around this as well, that when you enter sort of a ritualized space. And by ritualized, there's a great book called The Power of Rituals, which talks a lot about this. But a ritual is, you know, requires three different things in order to be a ritual. It needs repetition, mm-hmm. it needs attention, and it needs intention. So I created these kind of secular rituals where you would say, here's what I'm going to get done today. But the science of these implementation intentions, they're called, suggests that firstly, stating what you're going to do significantly increases the chance that you will do it. But even more so, if you have a connection with the person that you say it to, it increases it even further. And so what I would then do is create these moments of, you would tie in the intention setting with a moment of bonding in some way, like a fun question or something playful that would then create a moment of, it doesn't have to be very, very extensive, just a minute each, but you suddenly have a bond and you care a little bit about that person. And it's all about these little incremental increases in the likelihood that you're going to get something. I can't force you to do something, but I can create an environment that incrementally increases the chances and the probability and your likelihood that you can. And so that's what I experimented with and then have built into the way Flynn works. So at the beginning of every session, you have to, there's a ritual around it where you say, right, everyone, what are you going to work on in this session? And here's another question. What's your favorite, you know, childhood cartoon character? And then at the end of the session, you state what you got done and how you're going to play now. So again, we're, you're creating these moments of human connection, you're ritualizing, you know, these intention setting questions, and you're embedding a little bit of play into work.
And so how many people did you have in the chateau then? That sounds like it was,
I mean, not that many. Over this, over like the 2 weeks, we probably had about 20.
Okay. And so you're now kind of creating all of this online, a lot of it, although you are doing some pop-up flocks as well, talk to us about the different things and how it operates and how it works.
Firstly, I'm going to preface this by saying it will sound weird when I first say it, and everyone always is a bit, what why would that work? And also, why post-pandemic would I want to be looking at, you know, essentially another Zoom call, which it's not, but it kind of, you know, it's people on camera. Aren't we a bit exhausted by that? But hear me out, because it really is crazily effective. So one of the metaphors I use to describe what we do is that we're a peloton for work, or like a soul cycle for work, in the sense that, yes, you could exercise by yourself, but it is a lot easier, a lot more effective if you've paid something to do it. There's a schedule that you've put into your calendar. You said, yep, I'm going to be there. There's a really charismatic instructor that is turning what would otherwise be a very dull, you know, unappetizing task, exercise, into something that feels like an event, a produced event that is unique and full of, you know, content and personality. And you're surrounded by other people who are also showing up there to do the same thing. It can be quite transformational. And that's why a lot of these brands really bake into their narrative that they are not just about exercise. They're a lifestyle brand about transformation. And it's true. So I thought, well, what if we bring the same elements into how we work? So similar to that, there's a to Peloton, there's a schedule of classes a schedule of sessions that you can attend, and there's different formats. So you can do a 2-hour deep dive, you can do a 1-hour power hour. They have instructors, facilitators that we have hired and trained, and they're charismatic, diverse people that infuse that 1 or 2 hour work session with a bit of energy, a bit of production values. You're there with other people that have also shown up because for the next 2 hours they want to get something done. And it's people from around the world doing all sorts of different things. So you've got people showing up that are going to be you know, doing a pitch deck if they're an entrepreneur, or you've got someone from Indonesia doing a big Excel spreadsheet, or you've got a wedding celebrant in Scotland that's preparing vows, or you've got an artist in Perth preparing a watercolor. All these different forms of human knowledge that are coming together, and for the next 2 hours, they're inching away at human knowledge by bit. And it's so inspiring because you sometimes feel, if you're working alone, that you're just there in your room, everything's the same. It can sap you of some spirit.
Totally.
But suddenly you're there and you're surrounded by these other people that are working.
I use it, and I've found it very useful, particularly on days when it's, you have got a clear run of things and you don't have any kind of meetings in the diary. And it does, Yeah, I find it's the kind of ignition to kind of get going, which can be quite hard when you're like at home. I mean, I don't think it's something that entrepreneurs generally sort of struggle from too much to kind of get going, but the focus for entrepreneurs can be tough, I think, sometimes, because there's just so many things.
I think it's just it's about ritualizing something. It's the same reason why, you probably do have the discipline to go and exercise, but it's so much easier if you have a ritual that involves other people and there's a process around it. And so you start to associate that environment with exercise. And in this case, you're saying, right, because I'm going to do an hour of focus now, that environment that I'm in, which is, a screen that has faces working at their computers from around the world, can trigger in your mind this grounded sense that, right, now it's time to focus. Now it's time to do that thing on that to-do list that I've been dreading for a while. And so the session then, after the initial few minutes of the facilitator getting you all revved up, is then silence while you all work on camera. And that's the important thing, because for body doubling the effect to work, you need to be observing other people working. You need to see it, because then that triggers the mirror neurons in your brain to replicate what you're observing. And similarly, you need to be camera on, so you're giving back the gift of body doubling. Yeah. So it's this wonderful reciprocity of people from professionals from around the world that are giving each other the gift of each other focusing that helps them focus. And then at the end of the session, well, for the longer sessions, you've got a bit of a break in between that the facilitator leads. It can be a playful break. It can be a meditative break. And you work again. And then at the end, you share what you got done. There's also unstructured formats that you can drop in and out at any time. And then there's also recharge content for meditation or planning or breath work that is also needed to create a healthy practice. So that's what it is. And it sounds nutty. Like, why on earth would I be watching other people work? But if you think about it, Twitch, for those who don't know, Twitch is a platform where you watch other people play computer games. Phenomenally successful. There is something very powerful about this voyeuristic experience. Yeah. And it's incredibly effective, particularly for those that have ADHD or other neurodivergencies.
Just tell us about how many people Flown are, how much you've raised, etc., and all of that.
Sure. So, I funded the initial pre-seed fundraise for it during the pandemic, just as my last company was getting acquired.
Yeah.
It was a surreal time. And then...
Because that's it. You started Flown basically at the beginning of the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is pretty extraordinary timing.
It was. It actually began as a very different company. The first version of it was more like an Airbnb for deep work spaces, physical spaces. But because this was going to be much more of an impact-driven company, I really wanted this to be, really impactful to humanity. I recognized that a platform that only offered rich people expensive things some of the time was not really going to be the way that I could have impact. So I concurrently also offered these online focus sessions as an accessible part of the platform. And as, 2020 and 2021, and unveils as they did, it became both apparent that I was trying to do too much with a pre-seed team and budget. The proposition was too complicated to communicate, and that actually there was just a lot more creative bandwidth, creative possibility, focusing on this concept of what does the future of work look like if we think about creating these spaces for focus, much more so than, if I had stayed with the physical spaces, I would be always replicating Airbnb functionality. It wasn't creatively very satisfying. But this feels, I'm creating a new category that doesn't exist yet. Yeah. And that's really fulfilling and I think potentially quite impactful. So, then we did another, a small seed raise. And we're now close to closing sort of a late seed extension, and we're about 13 people in the team.
Have you found it easier, or what have you noticed? Because I'm sure you would have found it easier raising money this time than the previous time for lots of different reasons. But what has the impact of being a second time entrepreneur been on fundraising?
Significant. Yeah. And it was funny because the first the first raise was the easiest fundraise I've ever done, because I timed it almost perfectly to start the fundraise the week that the announcement of my last company's acquisition was made.
Yeah.
So it was actually almost a problem because I at that point was like, well, I don't need to raise that. I can just do this on my own now. And so I told the investors that I was due to meet that, oh, I don't know if I need your money now. I think I might just do this myself. Which, of course, is exactly the thing you say when you want them to give you money, because they were like, no, 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 please let me give you your this money on any terms you want. And that was just very difficult to say no to.
It's the old thing about going to seeing go and ask for advice and you'll get money.
Right.
Go and ask for money and you'll get advice.
So then you're on the hamster wheel and there is no getting off it once you start on the teat of VC money. Then the second time around, then, you know, it becomes less easy the more, you know, the further along that you are, because then you just need to really show results. I have a big network. I have, I think a reasonably good reputation. I find it easy to get introductions to whoever I need. And I understand, I coach people on how to raise money. So I know how to do it. I know how to tell a narrative. I know the things that they're looking for. And I've done it before. And so that counts for a lot. You know, I know how to build a company, expand to the US, build a culture, get a company sold. And that's, yes, of course, that's going to be advantageous. But, after a point, you also then need to build a good product that generates enough revenues and enough growth. And that becomes, no amount of story, spinning can overcome that if you're not also a good product.
You've been an entrepreneur for a long time. So even before the kind of London tech scene boom kind of 2009, 2010, you were doing Skimlinks back. You started in 2008, I think.
Yeah.
Right. So, and you did that for 10 years and had a bit of success with it. Tell us about Skimlinks and the idea behind that in 2008. And it must have changed a lot in the decade that you did, right?
Well, it began as a pre-Pinterest clone. Like, it was not a clone because I did it before Pinterest, but Pinterest obviously did it better. But it began as a company called Skimbit, which is a terrible name. that was a social decision-making tool that helped skim the best bits of sites that you liked to help you make a group decision. And so I came up with that as an idea in the middle of a Google job interview.
Right.
Basically, I had been living and working in London for 4 years, working for big corporates. And then I had my last sort of 9 months in London. I started working at a startup and really loved it and decided that I would never work for a big company again.
Yeah.
I then moved back to Australia thinking, as all Australians do, that I've done my 4-year stint. I'm now back home, to do what Aussies do. And I got back to Australia and, swore that I would never work for a small company, a big company again. So I was doing a bit of consulting. And then the opportunity came up to do a product manager job interview for Google Maps.
Oh, wow.
And I was so torn because I love maps.
Yeah.
It's an incredible opportunity.
As a nomad, after all, right?
I just love maps. It's just so cool to look at. but it was a big company. Like, Google is undeniably a big company, and it was going to break my vow. So what do I do? So I thought, look, let's just go with the interview. You don't have to take it. Let's just see what happens. And so you go through several rounds, and in the final day of interviews, so there was the third or so set of interviews, you had to go in, and there was about 4 interviews that day. And the penultimate interview, they said, right, come up with a product idea and talk about how you'd monetize it. And so, in that moment, I'm thinking, what do I talk about? And I had remembered, in that moment, these disparate strands of my life sort of came together, and I remembered this idea I'd had for a tool that would extract metadata from product websites and create almost a comparison site for you that could be shareable, that would help with group decision making when you're looking at a TV to buy or a villa to rent for a holiday or that kind of stuff. And then I also then knew enough about the tech for how I could build it in that moment, and I just brought the two together and started pitching this concept of a social decision-making tool that would be a plugin that could extract metadata and create these comparison sites for yourself. And as I'm talking about this, I'm getting super excited, like, wow, this could actually be a good thing.
Yeah.
And I think, I like to think, my own personal mythology of this moment is that, you know, powers that be then screwed up my final interview because I was atrociously bad in the final interview, so bad that at one stage I had to stop the interview to say, I actually am a smart person. I'm so sorry. It was such a bad interview, but I'm convinced that it was, you know, the universe saying that, don't get the job. I did not get the job, but I did start Skimbits the next day. And so for the next year, I sort of built this from my living room in Sydney while I was working full time as well. And after about a year, you know, had a product that was kind of workable and didn't really know what to do next. So I went to like the one VC in Sydney. At the time, there was no startup scene in Australia.
Yeah.
And I pitched this amazing product. Would you give me money for this? And he said, no. And then I was a bit stuck. So that was such an Aussie thing to say, no. So I then went on, you know, did again what Aussies do and went on a walkabout. So I just booked a 6-week trip to go traveling around Europe to see if I could work out what I was going to do next. And as it turns out, I popped back into London to see some friends that were entrepreneurs as well. And they basically inspired me and encouraged me to, and really transformed my life, because my friend said, well, look, why don't you pivot it to be a white label version of this decision-making software? And I've got a potential first client for you. And I've got someone that might give you some free office space and help you with getting a bank loan.
Wow.
So while I'm on holidays, I had to like borrow some clothes from a friend. I had to create a pitch deck. I went to see this wedding websites and pitched them this product that I hadn't built yet, and convinced them that I had built it and I was living here. And it was all just very like the embodiment of fake it till you make it. But they loved it and said, yes. And here's like 20 grand up front as a setup fee. And with our money, I built the product from scratch, went back to Australia, sold my car, sold my furniture, quit my job, you know, said goodbye to my mother, who was devastated that I was leaving Australia once again, and came back to London to be, you know, a full-time penniless entrepreneur. And for the next year, I kind of, you know, I got a bank loan, I got enough money from this client, and I managed to kind of hire like 2 or 3 people, but, and I was pitching to investors every day, trying to raise my seed round, and I couldn't, and I tried again, and I couldn't. And this is now 2008, so the world is starting to slide in recession, and I was aware that it was not going to get any easier. I needed to do something different. And so I decided to experiment with revenue models. Instead of being a subscription business, I thought, why not make it so it would be a revenue share business with ad spend, but no one would advertise on our site. And then I thought, well, hold on, if people are bookmarking products from retailers that have affiliate programs, why don't I monetize through revenue share on affiliate commissions?
Yeah.
And but to do that, we've got to come up with software that automatically turns these user-generated product links into trackable affiliate links.
Yeah.
So we built that technology just for ourselves. And I found that when I was pitching to investors and to potential customers, more people were interested in this like nerdy little monetization technology that we built for ourselves than in my social shopping website technology. Yeah. And so I realized that if I wanted to survive, I would have to dump everything I'd built for the last 2 years and just commercialize this monetization technology so other websites could use it.
Yeah.
And so we did. And that was Skimlinks. And then the rest is history. It became its own category.
Yeah.
It's, you know, by the time I stepped down, like $1 billion worth of e-commerce sales were going through our platform. We'd expanded to Silicon Valley and then to New York. We were an 80-person company. We were used by every major publisher and media company in the Western speaking world and many beyond that.
Yeah. That is, I mean, it's extraordinary, right?
It was a complete accident.
All because of a job interview at Google.
That went wrong, I know.
That is, and what would you have, what have you learned about hiring and interviewing over that time? I mean, you know, you sort of apologising for mucking up the interview. What do you, I mean, you've hired over, you know, hundreds of people. Yeah. Yeah, what have you learned about that process?
I mean, that it's always, you know, that I think that there are, it's always going to be a very difficult thing because there's only so much that you can get from those discussions. But
yeah.
what I try to do, I like to hear them tell stories of how they've approached their career and the decision making that has led them from one role to another.
Yeah.
Because I think being able to tell a narrative around your life is really important. I like to hear how they talk about their decision making processes and what inspires them to move from one place to another. I think that tells a lot about a person. I'm known for, I like to swear a little bit in an interview because I want to see how
typical
how they react. But I want to see how they react to, a moment of irreverence.
Yeah.
Because, and this is a personal thing, I don't think this is necessarily going to work for all people, but I know that I like to work with people that have a certain sense of humor or that can handle this kind of paradox of professionalism along with playfulness and how you can do both really well. And I think that's important for the kind of cultures I like to build. I look for people that are coachable.
So what reactions have you, the swearing thing's really interesting. So like what kind of reactions have you had to that?
Well, you see people that become very uncomfortable,
yeah.
And, which is a perfect, I don't think that they're bad people for it. It's just that we're likely not going to, especially, and I think this is even more so important in the early stages where the impact of a culturally not right person is much more impactful. When you're a bigger company,
yeah.
The company can handle, a certain percent of people that, are quite a more diverse than you had initially begun. And by diverse, I mean just different in their personalities. Mm. But in the early days when there's a lot of pressure, there's a lot of things that can go wrong, I look for people that can bring humor and acceptance and lightness into a situation. So that's just a nice way to test for that.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. I think it's really important. Yeah, obviously people have got to culturally be a fit, but that ability to kind of get on with each other and so on is really important. And, you won't get that from a kind of McKinsey hiring report, but it is, it matters a lot when you're kind of, particularly in the early days, when you're kind of in the trenches trying to make this thing work, right?
Exactly. I then look for coachability and humility. So how well do they take feedback I try to do an exercise of something and then see how they react and are they self-aware? Are they, oh, that's such a good point. Yeah. And, that you can build with them because I think that I'd much rather hire someone that's less experienced, but passionate, smart and coachable because you can teach them the rest. And then humility is important because, that's especially important in the early stages where there's going to be a blurring of lines between roles. And so you need someone that is willing to, pick up the pieces of someone else. And if you've got someone that's very ego driven, that's not a good fit in the early stages. They're the main things, but then I also make sure that they get to meet other people that approach interviewing a little bit different. So my sister, for example, who's a brilliant, brilliant interviewer and people leader, she has a very systematic approach. She really believes in having an interview guide beforehand with a set of what are the values and the skills that you're looking for across all your candidate set and what are the questions that you can ask. And she really believes in standardizing the process so it becomes really, really fair. And I love that being part of the process. It's just not like
the way you're gonna do
it. It's not, but I think that both are necessary. And so the union of both of those creates, I think, good decision-making process.
Totally. And what skills do you look for in the sort of facilitator roles?
We have a really rigorous screening process for facilitators, and not a lot of people get through it, but we're also looking for people that can bring different life experiences into it.
Yeah.
So we've got people that are actors, that are coaches, that are teachers, that are, all sorts of different backgrounds because we like the flavor that they bring into it.
And you do it yourself as well, right?
Yeah.
And talk to us more about, your journey of kind of Australia, UK, growing a business in the US as well, now Portugal, etc. Fascinating. Talk to us about your kind of like backstory. Like, where did it all begin? Where did the entrepreneurial zeal come from?
I don't know, because it wasn't, I mean, okay, perhaps it is, you know, an unexpected twist from my childhood, because I didn't come from that background. My dad was, you know, a farmer in Cuba, and then, you know, joined the counter-revolution against Castro and fought in the Bay of Pigs and was a political prisoner, wow. You know, very different from our lives. And then, you know, studied to be, he was going to be an electrical engineer because he won scholarships that, you know, topped him. He was a top student in all of Cuba at the time, but because he refused to join the Communist Party, he was denied his scholarship and his university placement, and so had to go to technical college instead to be an electrician. And then eventually he got out and became an exile, went to Spain, where he met my mother, who had been, her father had died when she was 12 or 13. And so she had to leave school in order to work and support her family. So she never finished school. And they got married, moved to Australia, and, you know, a few years later I was born. So we grew up, you know, quite simple means. My dad was an electrician. Mum was, you know, a homemaker. And then one day my dad had a bad accident at work and was basically paralyzed from his neck to his knees, and, you know, was in hospital for 3 months. So my mother had to, like, somehow take care of two daughters and work out what she was going to do for money. She ended up going to work as a presser in a dry cleaner.
Yeah.
And eventually my dad got out of hospital, but couldn't work. And so for the next decade, he looked after my sister and I, sister and me, and became very, you know, bitter, angry, because he'd lost, you know, his, you know, he was no longer the breadwinner.
Yeah.
He had lost a lot. And so in the landscape of that, you know, we were very, very poor. We never even went to a restaurant until I was 12 years old, and that was with someone else's family. But my parents really prioritized education, as many migrants do. And so every bit of money that we had went into sending my sister and me to a private school. Then I was lucky enough to get some scholarships, and that sort of helped the family along. But yeah, that whole background was, you know, I was really encouraged to study and do well and get a well-paying, secure job.
Yeah.
But I just always had, I remember watching this, you know, current affairs special on TV in Australia, where this guy was talking about being an entrepreneur, and, you know, I remember vividly, he said, it's just, success is just a choice. And I remember at the time going, wow, really? It's just a choice? Okay, I choose it. And that was it. I knew I wanted to be a businesswoman, which is kind of what it was called then. And so at high school, Young Enterprise was an initiative, which I'm sure. And it completely changed my life, because I was such a geeky, nervous, you know, shy kid in the corner with glasses studying. But suddenly in this, you know, this group of kids from other neighboring schools, we would get together once a week, and suddenly I was good at this. And they voted me managing director of our team, which no one had ever voted me for anything. And then the product idea that we came up with was this one. It was my idea that they voted for.
Well, what was it?
It was lip gloss. It was called Pout, and it was four different colors and scents, and it was brilliant branding, I thought.
Yeah, it was good.
We did so well. We won Venture of the Year in our state, and wow. I was finalist of Business Person of the Year for Young Enterprise, and I was like, oh my God, I think I found my calling. I'm good at this. And so throughout then my 20s, I like tried and failed a number of times to start companies.
Yeah.
And each time I failed, I was like, right, well, what didn't I know? How could I learn that skill? And then I would try to find a job that would teach me that skill.
That's, amazing. Better than my plant pots at our school, which seems dreadful. And then, talk about trying to hack the system. We got everyone to do a poem in the school, and then we badged it all up in a book and sold it to the parents, which, I mean, I'm sure, I think Your Enterprise said it broke the rules, basically, but we said we could make it work. But talk to us about your dad and the Cuba thing, because that's a pretty unique story, kind of
Well, I think going back to your earlier question about what made it, I think, so I didn't have any entrepreneurial roots per se, but I did have, you know, a father that was really ambitious to escape his peasant background. And he was super smart and he risked a lot. You know, he took a lot of big bets that, you know, in his, you know, he was very principled and, you know,
it's going against the grain as well.
Yeah. And then he, you know, left Cuba with nothing. You know, he arrived in Spain with literally the clothes he had on his body.
Yeah.
And then, you know, had to make it work. And then my mum and him went to Australia. They knew no one. They didn't speak the language and they had to make it work. So I think that there's commonalities of experience there that, you know, I guess I was raised with, even though I had to approach my entrepreneurial journey with a lot of resistance from my parents, because for them, they couldn't understand why I would not take the secure route given where I'd come from.
Yeah. What's it like working with your sister now?
Well, we worked together for the first sort of year and a half, 2 years. She's now running her own sort of consultancy with people team work. But I loved it. I love working with my sister, and she's one of the most, like, even though we're very similar of ways, we are extremely yin and yang in a lot of other ways.
Yeah.
And she really, her strengths very much balanced my weaknesses. I'm the more creative, visionary, you know, the charismatic person that can kind of see a path forward. And she's brilliant at taking those concepts and ideas and turning them into plans and executing them. So it was great.
that is a good matchup. And you're now living kind of in Lisbon, Portugal, becoming quite a kind of like entrepreneur tech sector, tech center in its own right. Why do you think that is?
I think that the pandemic, you know, really made people question a lot of, you know, a lot of life questions.
Yeah.
And as a step back, I moved to London in 2001 when it felt like the whole world was moving to London to chase their dreams.
Yeah.
Then a decade later in 2010, I moved to San Francisco, where it felt like the whole world was moving to San Francisco to chase their dreams. A decade later in 2020, I moved to Lisbon because it felt like everyone has moved to Lisbon to chase their dreams. But it feels like the dreams have changed and they're no longer about pure wealth and success. Mm. They're about, can we achieve that while also living a good and healthy life? And so I think that's why a lot of people have moved to Lisbon. A lot of people are working remotely there. And so they're still running international businesses, but they're doing so in a sunny climate, in a smaller city that's more affordable, where there's access to forest and surf and a really densely geographically located community of people that are also seeking the same things. And that's very appealing.
What's the population of Lisbon?
I mean, very small, I think. Like, I looked at this up recently, and I don't remember. It's about a million, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It is. I mean, yeah, London is incredible, but it is, my gosh, it's a megacity.
I mean, it took me an hour and a half to get here. and I only live in zone 2, and so do you.
Yeah, yeah. That is true.
Yeah.
What did you make of the Valley? I mean, what did you make of Silicon Valley and all that? I mean, I just think that is so, the few months I've spent out there, I came away thinking I really don't want to live there. But you spent a bit longer there, right?
I mean, I loved it. I was there at a super fun time.
Yeah.
You know, that was, you know, I was hanging out with the early Uber and Airbnb founders.
Yeah.
You know, Sean Parker would, you know, when TechCrunch Disrupt was on, would turn a derelict warehouse into a pop-up party with Snoop Dogg performing. And I managed to blag my way in, and as everyone did. And it was just a really heady time. Where anything was possible. I remember talking to one of the founders of Uber when they were still called Uber Cab, and he was like, we're going to drop the cab because we're going to be much more than just, you know, cabs. And I was like, that's a cool idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just that time when you feel like you were at the start of something. So it was wonderful fun, and I'm really grateful I got the chance to live there during that time. Yeah.
Do you think we're at that with that kind of moment with AI now, and the fact is you can be anywhere as well. That kind of being one of the different, I don't know why I was pointing at. You can be anywhere. Like, but that you can be, you can be anywhere with the AI revolution, right? Because all the tools are going to be available to you. You're not going to geographically need to be located in London or the Valley.
Correct. I mean, I think about this a lot because I think that it's, I was actually talking about this last night with this AI expert about, can you create a cultural movement if you're not physically together? And it's a really interesting question. Like, I think, you know, there used to be times that significant cultural moments happened because people coalesced together around art or music or, you know, dance or, you know, something. There was a swelling of human emotion that created a cultural moment in time. And now that's happening on TikTok. And there are moments when I'm wondering if that has the same cultural depth, I guess. But also maybe it's just that I'm not of that generation that has grown up in that, and maybe I'm not aware that there's a cultural, well, there is a cultural movement happening, but will I? Yeah, anyway, that's a whole other philosophical question.
But it is interesting. Yeah, the Dutch and Argentine elections that have delivered pretty surprising results in the last few weeks when we're recording this, like, a lot of it has come down from TikTok and, yeah, that sort of, those, it's not as, yeah, those people finding an audience, right, that kind of gives them a bit of treasure.
I think you can manipulate. I think you can create new opinions and perspectives. But it's engineered. I don't know. So I think that regardless, we are where we are, and a lot more work is going to be done in a distributed way, AI or Web3 or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
I am observant of whether that also requires a geographical base or not. And as someone that's chosen to leave London, I think about that sometimes. Like, I'm very happy with my decision, but will the forces of humanity overcome, overcome that desire to just be distributed, and instead, will there be a pull back to geographic physical centres? Will people come back to London or to San Francisco or Austin or Lisbon? Because beyond what you can do online, there are some opportunities, connections that need proximity of people.
Yeah.
To make impactful things. And I don't know the answer, but it's just something I'm pondering a lot at the moment.
Because you've done some pop-up flocks, haven't you?
Well, that's kind of part, yeah. That's so...
Literally in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I've always wanted to go back to doing physical things. We began as a physical company, and we made the decision to focus on these online focus spaces initially. But my long-term vision for Flown is that, you know, we deliver focus and flow and community online and offline.
Yeah.
And so these pop-up flocks, we call our focus sessions flocks, are an experiment in that. Like, it's not just about coming together online, but what if you do what Cal Newport in his book, Deep Work, calls the grand gesture of getting away from your day-to-day to do deep work. There's something about the intentionality of saying, you know what, I'm going to get away. I'm leaving my normal place of work because I want to get this thing done.
Yeah.
It creates an extra incentive to do something. So whether it be going to a deep work retreat, like the ones I used to run, or whether it be going to a space in Spitalfields where we're running our pop-ups, there's something about, I'm going to go for the next, because I need to get this pitch deck done or this like financial model done. And by going there, I'm saying to myself, I can't fuck around now.
Yeah.
I'm going to get this done. And also, there's also something great after the last few years that we've had to come together with other humans and work deeply together. And I think it's really interesting because you could argue, well, isn't that just like a co-working space? But ironically, I think co-working spaces can be very lonely because everyone's going there, and because it's asynchronous, you know, people come and then they leave and then they come and they leave. There's not that same sense of real community.
Yeah.
Whereas if you come together and you set like, okay, guys, we're, 10, 15 people now. We are going to do some work. What are we going to do? And people share, and there's this real moment of synchronicity, like, oh, wow, you're doing that. Oh, wow, good luck with that. And then you work together. You benefit from that communal
body-doubling
effect.
It's
the intention and the attention. I'm putting attention into this moment. And then you share what you got done, and there's a real moment of synchronized celebration,
yeah.
which I think is so important for the human experience. So yeah, I do think that there's a really important place for real world events and real world, you know, interactions to happen, even for AI to flourish.
Really interesting. As a final question, well, two, I mean, we always ask kind of book piece of content that people have read or watched lately, which you may well go with Cal Newport. I know. And also, is there, you know, pass the mic, is there another kind of entrepreneur that we should go and speak to that maybe hasn't got the coverage that, you know, they deserve yet, or is doing something interesting that we should have a chat with? You can always come back to us on these.
Oh,
as you look to the heavens.
In terms of the content, I do think the book Deep Work is great. But I also really like the power of ritual. I think that there's, I think that marrying the two ideas together is really powerful. This idea of focused deep work and what it can create for you and as, you know, as a species. But also the importance of secular or non-secular, but secular rituals for humanity and how we can weave that into the way that we work, the way that we do any of our habits to make them more meaningful and impactful. So I think that the marriage of those two books was really important for me and for Flown. And then another entrepreneur, you put on the spot, I'll have to come back to that one. There's just so many really interesting, I do have someone.
There we are.
So I went to high school with this incredibly happy woman. She was a Black South African whose parents were, you know, escaped apartheid and they came to Australia. She's had a really tough life. Both her parents died when she was young, and then she's had a child that has not one, not two, but three awful disabilities.
Gosh.
So cerebral palsy and fragile X syndrome and grand seizures. And so he's unlikely to walk or talk. And her husband left her. So she's a single mom, full-time carer. But in the midst of all of that, she is one of the most naturally gifted marketing brand geniuses I've encountered. So she's creating a line of adaptive wear for children, but that can actually be used by any child, because the truth is that, you know, when you have a child, it's really hard to get them into clothing easily. And so she's creating these one pieces that look like super fashionable, super cool outfits, but they're really thought through, functionally genius onesies. And I'm helping her, you know, from, you know, to build this up into, you know, her vision is that
What's
we can change.
Company?
Osh, named Osh. After her son. Yeah.
How's Osh spelled?
Well, her son's name is Ocean, like the sea.
Oh, right.
But okay, so spelled Ocean, O-A-S-H.
Amazing.
But it's still very early, but I think she is, I think she's destined for greatness, and I'm there to support her do that.
Well, trust me, somebody who has to get 3 under 4s ready each morning at the moment, I can well empathise with it. And like, yeah, I can see it's definitely a target market for that. And ready again in the evening. thanks so much for coming on Jimmy's Jobs of the Future. It's been a real pleasure.
Jimmy.
It's been
Thank
great.
You.
And we will be doing some pop-up vlogs in 2024 as well. So we'll make sure we put some links in the show notes, comments below, so people can join. Because I do think it's a really interesting idea. Partly the team, Jimmy's Jobs is going to be there, but also for listeners who are kind of in that sort of solopreneur space, I think it's really interesting.
Awesome. I'm excited to host you.